Alright, good evening to everyone. Welcome to Great Decisions Part 6. Discussing tonight European jewelry in the 1930s, options and consequences. Sponsored again by Becky and Avi Katz, Le'ili Nishmas, Yona Ben Ravaria Leib. So tonight we find ourselves less than a decade before the start of one of the greatest catastrophes ever to befall the Jewish people. 1933. The questions are, what were we thinking? How did Jews respond to the rise of Hitler and Nazism? Jews of Europe we're talking about. How did Jews view the possibility or the imperative of immigration, and was it feasible for most? A few general points must be stated at the outset. This is unlike our discussion from a few weeks ago of the Great Migration from 1880 to 1920. You recall those millions of Jews who left Europe were largely refugees, but most were not as desperate as the Jewish refugees in Europe in the 30s would be. And remember that even if 2 million Jews fled Tsarist Russia during the Great Migration, 3 million stayed. Secondly, and I think very importantly for our perspective, hindsight is 20/20, and we should never look back dismissively on this or that group of Jews who did not leave and ask why not. Of this we say with humility, Al tadinas chavercha shetagil umkomo. Don't judge another person until you're standing in his place. Who says we're so smart? Israelis often tell me, don't you see the signs? And we're all children of the Holocaust. We have the Holocaust as a paradigm to follow. So we shouldn't sit in judgment, although we'll try to understand what they were thinking. Yet we'll look at who left and why, who stayed and why, who warned people to leave and were not heeded for whatever reason, and who told people to stay and whether they were heeded. And finally, we'll look at those Jews who wanted to leave. Where did they go? What were the options? Where could they have gone? Which countries were open to Jewish immigration and which were not? And before we draw conclusions about good or bad decisions, we should ascertain what realistic choices they had. Mindful of, just to take one example, the statement of the Australian representative at the Evian conference in France, the refugee conference in 1938, who said, as we have no real racial problem, we are not desirous of importing one. By racial, of course, he meant Jewish. So what was Jewish life like in the 30s? So look at three different clips, totally all told about 8 or 9 minutes or so, and all those frame the issue tonight. And as always, I thank the Rabbi Wein and the Destiny Foundation for providing us with the video clips and introduction as well. So please, if someone can hit the lights, we'll start. Naturally, I can't get the simple.
Secularization of the Jewish people. with the fact that a large proportion of the Jewish people no longer were observing, that followed different governments. The left, communism, socialism, they even felt that they're doing, so to speak, God's work in opposing religion. And this competition on the street, the newspapers, the essays, all of this made for a very, very vibrant Jewish life, almost a chaotic Jewish life. Because so much was going on, and everyone seemed to be against everyone.
In the interwar period, I told him, the book was one of many actors on the Jewish political street. It was Israel, Mizrahi, various Zionist organizations, Left Polizien, Right Polizien, a huge plethora of Jewish organizations, each with its own newspaper, with its own football club, with its own schools.
How deeply this divided Jewry is reflected in the story of one man, the family of Mordechai Tenenbaum.
This family was a religious family. The parents were religious, but in the crisis of the interwar period, each of the six children chose a different Jewish direction. One became a Bundist, another became more religious. Mordechai himself was later the leader of the Zionist underground in the Bialystok ghetto. And so we can see how the crisis of the period impacted on one family. They all remained Jews, but they chose different kinds.
Then there also were developments, new developments, women's education in Eastern Europe, which until the First World War was nil, except for individuals, but as a system didn't exist. And now the Beis Yaakov school system was created. Sarah Schneer was able to enlist the aid of great rabbis and Hasidic leaders to back it. And now you had tens of thousands of religious women that attended school, that were literate. That was a great change, a great revolution. That it was a step towards modernity. Eastern European Jewish life was also influenced by technological advance. Radio, Jewish theater reflected different viewpoints. The great cantors gave concerts and made records, the old vinyl 78 records, and it was a new world.
Despite all the changes, social, political, philosophical, and economic, and the defection of so many Jews from traditional Judaism, Orthodox life, especially in Poland and Lithuania, remains strong and highly motivated.
Eastern European Jewish life, in its religious sector, was led by such luminaries as Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, known as the Chofetz Chaim, and Rabbi Chaim Ozer Gorzhensky, who was the untitled rabbi of Vilna, then really the strong man of the Lithuanian Jewish world. And the Hasidic world was led by the Gera Rebbe and the other rebbeim that existed then that had large and powerful courts. You had very, very strong leadership, and you had very powerful people.
Okay, next clip. Well, we have two more.
With America and most of the world's doors closed to mass Jewish immigration, one surprising country, as late as 1937, still allowed Jews with financial means to immigrate, and that was British control, Palestine.
Those Jews who had a bit of capital and could smuggle it out of the country, they could get into Palestine with no problem at all, because according to the British instructions, those capitalists, namely people with more than a some English pounds, could get a certificate no matter what. As many as they want About 50,000 Jews from Germany immigrated to Palestine during those years. Now, the exceptional thing about this immigration wave was that here, for the first time in the history of immigration in Palestine, the Jews who came from abroad were on a higher cultural, economic, and social level than the Jews in Palestine. This was a very important addition to the makeup of Jewish society in Palestine. Now, we have to understand the importance of this period. There was here a discrepancy. While the Jewish world, the Jewish people in Europe were undergoing one of the worst periods in their existence, Palestine knew prosperity and growth and a promise of a future for the Jews. So for the first time in Jewish history, Palestine became the main country for Jewish immigration, the main country for Jewish refugees. And so, in a way, the balance between Europe and Palestine changed.
Okay, one more.
It's those that have nothing that find it easier to leave.
And because of that, therefore, that we had religious groups that said, you're not allowed to leave, we have to stay here till the Messiah comes. They said, can't go to America because there nobody can be Torah observant. Can't go to the land of Israel because there somehow it's controlled by the secularists. All Judaism will be destroyed. So we'll stay here and fight it out. The communists, for instance, said we have to stay here and build communism. Cowardly to leave. And the liberals said, how can you leave? You know, Germany is our fatherland. How can we abandon it now in the time of trouble? We have to stay here and rectify the situation. So again, in retrospect, it's all frightening how blind everybody was, but that's because we have perfect hindsight. They did not have that. What the Holocaust was unimaginable. It was unimaginable to the world generally and to the Jewish world particularly.
Okay, and that becomes our major focus tonight. What exactly were they thinking at the time? So first, how many Jews are we talking about? In 1933, the American Jewish Yearbook reported that approximately 9.5 million Jews lived in Europe. At the time, that's just 1.7% of the total European population, but about 60% of the world Jewish population, that then was around 16 million souls. The majority of the Jews lived in Eastern Europe. In 1933, Poland had about 3 million Jews, a little less than 10% of the Polish population. Western Russia, 2.5 million. Romania had 980,000 Jews. Added to that, the three Baltic states had about 250,000, with more than 60% of those in Lithuania. Now, these territories therefore contained about 6.5 million Jews. That's 1933. 1939 had slightly more than that. And the Holocaust took its greatest toll there. That is to say, the Nazis and their henchmen achieved their greatest number of victims here in this area. In fact, this area, excluding Romania and including Ukraine, was called the Bloodlands by Timothy Snyder, the historian, in his chilling book of the same name. The Bloodlands, Poland, Western Russia, Ukraine, an area in which Hitler and Stalin, the maximum between them, murdered approximately 14 million people. 14 million, including the 6 million Jews, including 5 million Jews in that area, with Hitler starving more than 4 million Russians to death, and Stalin in the 30s starving more than 3 million Ukrainians to death. So those were the bloodlands. When World War II started, Poland had about 3.3 million Jews. In 1950, 3.3 million. In 1950, 5 years after the war, the Jewish population of Poland was 45,000. Romania decreased from less than 1 million to 280,000. Russia retained the largest community, close to 2 million Jews, because remember, only Jews in Western Russia were affected by the Nazis. The others had to deal with Stalin, but Stalin did not single out Jews to be killed during the war. That came later. Meanwhile, in Western Europe, the largest Jewish community was in Germany, with about 550,000 Jews in 1933. 550,000 Jews sounds like a lot. The Nazis' favorite slogan was that the Jews were unser Unglück, our misfortune. The German Jews were less than 1% of the total population of Germany. And yet they had a high profile because they were concentrated in six major cities. Slightly more than 40% of German Jews, 180,000, lived in Berlin. And the Jews were disproportionately doctors and lawyers and professionals and professors, and disproportionately assimilated as well. So despite the small numbers of Jews in real terms, they made a great impression on the society. Hungary had about 445,000 Jews in 1933, but more than 800,000 in the census of 1941. Many Jews fled to Hungary when war broke out. World War II did not come to Hungary in earnest until 1944. In 1933, Czechoslovakia had 357,000 Jews, Austria 191,000, most of them lived in Vienna. France had 250,000, the Netherlands 156,000, Greece 100,000, Yugoslavia 68,000, Bulgaria 49,000, and Denmark 6,000. I mentioned the latter too because almost all their Jews were saved, Bulgaria and Denmark. Now, their fates of these various countries and the Jewish populations are determinable through the victim statistics. At least the first major conclusion that the film clip alluded to, most Jews felt that Hitler was a German problem and not really a European Jewish problem until it was too late. So interestingly, German Jews realized this naturally. The Tsarist began in Germany, and they emigrated in large numbers in the 1930s, so much so that about 130,000 German Jews were murdered by the Nazis during the war. A little more than half the German Jewish population at the start of the war, but only about a quarter of the Jews who lived there in 1933. That means fully half, actually more than half, of German Jews escaped before the war, as you might expect, because Hitler's evil was front and center in Germany. Conversely, 90% of Polish Jewry, Germany's eastern neighbor, was murdered during the Holocaust. Close to 3 million souls. 94% of Lithuanian Jews, 220,000. Aside from Ukraine, where 900,000 Jews were murdered, two-thirds of the Jewish population, Russian Jews fared relatively well. It's all relative in these macabre statistics. More than 100,000. But only 100,000 were murdered by the Nazis, and of course many others died fighting in the Red Army, otherwise suffered as civilians in the siege of St. Petersburg, Moscow, etc. Hungarian Jewry was devastated late in the war, close to 500,000 Hungarian Jews, but when you add the others who took refuge there, it comes closer to 800,000. Almost 90% of Greek Jewry were murdered, close to 80% of Dutch Jewry were murdered, and some communities, as I noted, were relatively unscathed. Two countries openly protected their Jews. King Boris of Bulgaria saved all his Jews. No Bulgarian Jews were killed during the Holocaust, and it was because of the king, the government, and the people. He was only unable to protect Jews from territories that Hitler had awarded him when the war started, like Macedonia. He, King Boris, was a reluctant ally of the Axis powers. But he personally stopped the deportation of Jews from Sofia, and he paid a price for it. In 1943, after meeting Hitler, he died the next morning. He had come for dinner in Berlin. He was apparently poisoned to death by Hitler. Now, the country was Denmark, of course, conquered by the Nazis. Denmark is situated, the thumb sticking out of the northern part of Germany. They saved their Jews as well in a remarkable overnight maritime escape to Sweden in October 1943. Thousands of Danish Jews were ferried out of Denmark to Sweden almost overnight. Jews previously who had been arrested in the streets by the Nazis were literally saved by Danish mobs. The mobs would surround and pounce on Nazi soldiers or SS officers and rescue those Jews and take them to safety. That's one of the great stories of the Holocaust. It's told in detail in the Museum of the Resistance in Copenhagen, which you should all visit. In all, maybe 60 Danish Jews were murdered during the Holocaust, just caught by the Nazis before they were saved. Some countries provided refuge to Jews, were not involved in the war. Franco Spain refused to cooperate with Hitler regarding the Jews. Switzerland's 12,000 Jews were shielded. They even hosted refugees as well. Although Switzerland, neutral Switzerland, did allow trains destined for concentration and death camps from France to pass through its territory. And of course, neutral Sweden protected its Jews as well, and others too. So where could they have gone in the 30s? As we noted, the Jews who felt Hitler's sting first were the first and the quickest to leave. The doors of the Western democracies began to close in the mid-1920s, as we discussed last week, and even America's restrictive immigration quotas went unmet. Thus, from 1933 to 1938, the U.S. quota was limited to 26,000 Germans per year, not all German Jews, but Germans generally. It's 130,000 people in potential, but only 63,000 were admitted. Some 500,000 Jews escaped Europe in the 1930s, with 80% coming from Germany, Austria, and Czechoslovakia, again, the first three countries that were directly affected by Hitler, and all, Czechoslovakia being the last, a half year before the war broke out. Of the 500,000, 112,000 came to the U.S., but 85,000 went to Latin America. And in the latter, that's very interesting, in the latter context, one fascinating character was the dictator of the Dominican Republic, Rafael Trujillo, who himself offered to accept 100,000 Jews in 1938, but far less than 1,000 actually took him up on his offer to come to the Dominican. Most who did were German and Austrian Jews, who were each given 80 acres of land, 10 cows, a mule, and a horse, and told to go farm. If you have the image in your mind of a Yeki with his mule and horse, then you'll chuckle. Trujillo was actually looking for Western support that they should overlook his massacre of 25,000 Haitians in 1937. Remember, the Dominican and Haiti share an island. And he openly admitted he wanted to whiten his population, so he hoped that these Jews, many of them single, would marry locals. In fact, many of them did. They all lived in the same community. The community still exists now as relatively few Jews today, but it's close to the well-known Dominican resort of Puerto Plata, just a few miles from there. Other Jews went to Cuba. My sister-in-law's mother was born in Cuba because her parents left Europe and went to Cuba in the late 30s. Remember that St. Louis was supposed to dock there because they all had Cuban landing permits, which were then denied once they arrived. There are several villages of Polish Jews who went en masse to Costa Rica. That's why the Costa Rican community is predominantly Ashkenazi. Their story is also told in the Jewish Museum in San Jose, Costa Rica, also worth a visit. Panama has a similar story. It's still home to the descendants of European Jews who fled in the 1930s. But Latin America did not really have a religious infrastructure, and that inhibited more religious Jews from ever considering that destination. More than 70,000 of America took the most, 112,000 Latin America. More than 70,000 Jews went to Great Britain, which turned out to be a better bet to them than the 30,000 who just went westward in Europe to France and found themselves caught up in the war anyway, the people in the school who were part of that migration. But a full 56,000 Jews went to Eretz Yisrael, as you heard that professor from Tel Aviv University say. And that, in fact, was most unusual, because Zionism really was a foreign entity to German Jews, whether they were religious or secular. And yet, when they came to Israel, you heard about the cultural advances they brought. They attracted attention because of their jackets and formal dress, which they insisted on wearing in Tel Aviv, and the European culture they brought with them that were unknown to the earlier Olim. In fact, there's some etymologists who say the term Yeki dates from that period. They were called the jackets, because they were the only people in the region who would wear jackets, these German Jews who came in the 1930s. Just as an aside, the German colony in Yerushalayim has nothing to do with them. That was founded by Protestants, German Templars in the late 19th century. These German Jews mainly concentrated in Tel Aviv. Now, Israel always represents the most tantalizing possibility, both historical and philosophical. In the 1930s, there were limitations on Jewish immigration to Israel. The British had, although it wasn't quantified, but the Zionist establishment also had. From 1933 on, they explicitly excluded anti-Zionists or non-Zionists from receiving immigration certificates. Meaning they wanted to bring in European Jews, but they wanted to bring in European Jews who shared their philosophy and shared their politics. The British High Commissioner, Herbert Samuel, had drastically reduced immigration already in the 1920s, but by the 1930s he was gone. And it's interesting, the Peel Commission in 1937 completely rejected, the Peel Commission was a British commission, they completely rejected the traditional British claim that the land could not absorb more Jews, 1937, because they pointed to the high rate of immigration in the 1930s. The Jews did come, and the land did absorb them. So, for example, the highest total in the 1920s were the 34,000 Jews who made Aliyah from Europe in 1925. But from 27 to 31, less than 20,000 were admitted to Israel over that four-year period. When Hitler came to power, that all changed. In 1933, 37,000 Jews came. 1934, 45,000. 35, 67,000. And then a decline, not because of quotas, but because of a lack of interest. 1936, only 29,000. 37, only 10,000. 38, 14,000. In 1939, as the drums of war were being sounded, 31,000 Jews made Aliyah from Europe. But then in May, the white paper took effect. Legal immigration was diminished to 10,000 in 1940. Less than 5,000 came in 1941. And that was even less than the quotas, to be 15,000 a year. And by then, of course, it was impossible to leave or difficult to leave. 2 points, therefore. When Hitler's claws spread across Europe, the British chose the absolute worst time to effectively halt Jewish immigration to Israel. But when there was an opportunity, even if the U.S. and Britain and other countries were not fully accessible, Eretz Yisrael was. But most Jews did not avail themselves of the opportunity. How different would history have been if, in fact, more Jews had left Europe and come to Israel? Would have been completely different. Now, to get personal for a moment, a look at my family, which of course should interest all of you, is very instructive. No family is typical. Every family to survive has a story. But I think our faith is fairly typical. Tonight happens to be my grandfather's yahrzeit, his 30th yahrzeit. Rav Ephraim Michel ben Rav Zev Nechemia Halevi. My grandfather was a shaychet in Pruzhina, where our name comes from, in Poland. During his lifetime, Pruzhina went from being a Lithuanian town to a Polish town to today it's part of Belarus. Such a wonderful place, everybody fights over it. Now, a shaychet in Poland was considered a good, well-paying job. So he had no interest in leaving Europe. And even after the Poles banned Shchita in the mid-30s, he continued shechting in secret. Interestingly, history always repeats itself, but just in the last week or two, Poland has again banned Shchita, even though there are very few Jews living there. Poland, since communism fell, has a $250 million annual meat industry of kosher and halal meat. So the catalyst for the ban seemed to be less Jew hatred, more the animal groups and the anti-Muslim groups that they're trying to keep out. But my grandfather had no intention of leaving until he was arrested in 1938 for Shchita. And then the following happened, the story I've told once or twice here and written in the introduction to one of my books, one of the stories of my great-grandfather. So my great-grandfather, my grandmother's father, had come to America earlier in the decade. And as the story goes, he was giving a shiur. My brother knows the story, of course. He was giving a shiur in Mishnayos between Mincha Maariv in a shul on Thayil Street in the Bronx when a stranger walked in looking lost. It's late 1938. My great-grandfather finished the shiur before Maariv walked over to him and said, in Yiddish, can I help you? He didn't speak any English. And the man said, yes, I have yahrzeit for my father. It's the first yahrzeit, and I don't know what to do. I don't know when to say Kaddish. My great-grandfather stood next to him and said Kaddish together with him, and invited him back the next morning to say Kaddish again for Shacharis and Mincha. So the man came, and after davening the next morning, he thanked my great-grandfather profusely, saying that if he could ever be of any help, to please call him. He introduced himself as Harry Sandberg, who is the head of the Star Democratic Club, the local political organization. So my great-grandfather immediately said, as a matter of fact, perhaps you can help me. My children and grandchildren, meaning his daughter, her husband, and their three children, one of them was my father, are trapped in Europe, late 1938, and they cannot get visas. Can you please do something? So Sandberg demurred, and he apologized that he's asked all the time, but unfortunately has no jurisdiction in that area. So my Zeta, thinking quickly, said to him, let me suggest something else. Why don't you write a letter to the local congressman, James Fitzpatrick, and ask him, have him write to the American Embassy in Warsaw, and as a personal favor to him, the congressman, maybe they could offer visas to my children and grandchildren. And he said he'll try, but don't expect anything. For whatever reason, Congressman Fitzpatrick of the 24th Congressional District in the Bronx wrote not one, but two letters to the embassy. 3 months later, my grandparents were told to come to Warsaw to pick up their visas, and my grandparents and their children arrived in the U.S. on Lincoln's birthday in 1939 on the last boat that left Poland for America before the inception of World War II. The Musa always is, in life, actions of consequences, and even small actions can have great consequences. Our whole family was saved and given renewed life, I'm standing here before you tonight, only because my great-grandfather walked over and welcomed a stranger in shul. Sometimes we're given one opportunity to accomplish something, and if we do not embrace that opportunity, it never repeats itself. I'll give you a brief postscript. So more than, my father was a small child when he came. More than 20 years later, he began his law practice in the Bronx, and during his first week in court, he noticed the name of a Bronx Supreme Court judge that sounded familiar, Harry Sandberg. Indeed, Harry Sandberg had risen from heading the Star Democratic Club to election as a state assemblyman and finally to be a judge. It was a natural progression in the Bronx. So my father knocked on the door of the judge's chambers, was escorted in, and the judge, without even looking up from his newspaper, said to him, "Yes, counselor, how can I help you?" And my father said, "I want to thank you for saving my life." And that at least got his head up from the newspaper. And he looked up, he was puzzled, and he said, "What are you talking about?" And my father said, "You were the one, you remember, it was my grandfather helped you say Kaddish in the shul on Fail Street and suggested you ask a congressman to write a letter." And the congressman did, and we survived. And then my father had become an attorney. And the judge, who did not even know what had happened, broke down in tears, and they embraced and they cried. That's one part of the story. My grandfather, Olav Shalom, had a sister and a brother. His sister made Aliyah in 1938 with her husband, and their descendants live in Israel until today. One of her sons was killed, Nebuch, in the War of Attrition. And my grandfather's brother, Yoshua, one of my brother's names, did not think to leave until it was too late. He was drafted into the Polish cavalry. He fought against the German tanks with his horse, and he was killed in battle, and his wife and daughters were murdered in Auschwitz. So they have really broken into threes. One came to America, really a nace. One went to Israel, and one perished in the Holocaust. The truth is, it's not typical, if you think about it. If the 3 million Polish Jews were killed out of 3.3 million, then really very few were saved. My other grandfather, my mother's side, his story is also, I guess, atypical. He came here in 1920 at the age of 15 with a brother and a sister. Another sister came in the ensuing two decades. In the 30s, two sisters made Aliyah. One sister was trapped in the war and spent the war years just hiding in the forests. His father died in the Bialystok ghetto, his mother in Treblinka, and other siblings were killed in the Holocaust, except for one brother who disappeared to the Soviet Union eastward and was never heard from again. So in a sense, that too is atypical. The fact of a family of 12, say, maybe half survived because most had left before the war, either to America or to Israel. Just again to follow the first story, so my great-grandfather succeeded getting my grandparents out of Europe Five of his grandchildren had come to America previously, but several others, married with children, never thought to leave, and they perished as well. Just being Menachem over some of the shul recently, just to show you how these stories go, he was telling me that his father came to America widowed in 1935. He brought two children with him. Every year he would save money to bring other children over, so he brought over another two children in the next 4 years, one child every 2 years, and then the war started, and several other children were murdered in the Holocaust. He himself, I remember, was his father remarried after the war, was born here in America. So why didn't more Jews leave? One thing indicated by the last story, and the one before that, is a dilemma that did exist in amongst European Jewry. Visas would come, but let's say visas came, but not enough for the whole family. You have five children and you get, say, four visas. What do you do? It's a choice that is it's impossible. I mean, usually they would decide to use some of them and leave. I saw, I was reading the Rabbi Weiner's an account of the Holocaust from, I think this is from Gideon Hausner's book, Judgment in Yerushalayim. So one of the people testifying at the Eichmann trial said that in one village the Nazis rounded up all the children and put them in the back of a convoy, and the mothers are screaming, and the mothers, one mother went over to a Nazi and said, "Can I have my children?" She said, he said, "I'll give you one." She had three children in the back of the truck. "You could take one." She went in the back of the truck and the three children were clawing at her, "Mama, mama, mama, how do you choose which one to take?" And in the end, she couldn't take any of them, and they all left. She didn't have the heart just to take one and leave the others behind. So why didn't more Jews leave? I mentioned what the Australian delegates at the Evian said. Canada's delegates at Evian blamed the Jews for their suffering. This is 1938, saying they brought it on themselves. Well, if that's how the civilized world felt, then who's to say to European Jewry that would be any friendlier outside of Europe? Obviously, most European Jews did not perceive the danger that they were in. Now, you heard Professor Bauer say that the Nazis, Hitler always spoke about exterminating Jews, but it was fanciful. It didn't have any practical effect. He said it became more serious in 1939, but in fact the final solution wasn't voted on until the Wannsee Conference in 1941, right outside of Berlin. So in fact it was 2 years into the war that the Nazis finally concluded to systematically exterminate all of Europe's Jews. So therefore it's hard to look back to European Jews in the 30s and say why they didn't foresee the Holocaust. It wasn't really a factor until much later. One who did and was criticized and reviled for it and seems prophetic today was Zev Jabotinsky, the revisionist leader. He not only warned Eastern European Jewry of the coming catastrophe for the better part of the decade, but he traveled there several times and he would go from place to place hectoring them to leave, and he even developed a plan for them to leave. In 1936, 3 years before the war, Jabotinsky prepared what he called the evacuation plan, which called for the evacuation of the entire Jewish populations of Poland, Hungary, and Romania to Israel. That's more than 4 million Jews, who most of them would die in the Holocaust. Talk of prescience. He personally enlisted the support of some major Jew haters, the Polish foreign minister, the prime minister of Romania, Admiral Miklos Horthy of Hungary, who became infamous during the Holocaust. Those three shared in common a hatred of Jews and a desire to rid their countries of the Jews. It was a perfect win-win. Jabotinsky wanted them and they didn't want them. So all three governments approved the plan. But the Polish Jewish leadership of the time opposed the plan, specifically because they objected to Jabotinsky's negotiating with the Jew haters who were persecuting them, the Polish government. And Chaim Weizmann dismissed it as impractical, and the British government vetoed it, so the plan died. And with it died probably the best chance to avert what became the Holocaust. And Jabotinsky was tormented by the failure, and he continued to warn Polish Jewry that they're living on the edge of a volcano. On Tisha B'Av 1938, now we're talking just 13 months before the war broke out, Jabotinsky spoke in Warsaw, and I quote, he said, "It is already 3 years that I am calling upon you, Polish Jewry, who are the crown of world Jewry. I continue to warn you incessantly that a catastrophe is coming closer. I became old, gray and old in these years. My heart bleeds that you, dear brother and sisters, do not see the volcano which will soon begin to spit its all-consuming lava. I see that you are not seeing this because you are immersed and sunk in your daily worries. Today, however, I demand from you trust. You are convinced already that my prognoses have already proven to be right. If you think differently, then drive me out of your midst. However, if you do believe me, then listen to me in this 12th hour. In the name of God, let any one of you save himself as long as there is still time, and time there is very little. What else I would like to say to you on this day of Tisha B'Av is, whoever of you will escape from the catastrophe, he or she will live to see the exalted moment of a great Jewish wedding, the rebirth and rise of a Jewish state. I don't know if I will be privileged to see it." He died 2 years later, 1940. "But my son will. I believe in this, as I am sure that tomorrow morning the sun will rise. Eliminate the gullus, or the gullus will surely eliminate you." That's some powerful speech. For his efforts, he was viciously attacked by, among others, the Jewish Bundists. And when he was coming to Vilna, they issued the following proclamation. "To the Jewish workers and Jewish masses of Vilna, the leader of the revisionists, the spiritual father of Jewish fascism, the paper general, Vladimir Jabotinsky, is coming to Vilna. Of late, this adventurer and political charlatan has become very popular. He has come to us to Poland with a grandiose plan to redeem the Jews from their Polish galut. His plan bears the military title evacuation. In the name of the Jewish folk, he publicly calls for the evacuation of 3 million Jews from Poland, which is to say, he simply asks for them to be driven out of the country. We are citizens with equal rights in this country! Exclamation point. We shall fight for work and for bread, for life and for rights here in Poland. We do not wish to escape from Poland. We shall not permit charlatans and adventurers to speak in our name. Together with the workers of the entire country and under the leadership of the Jewish working class party, the Bund, we shall fight and win the battle for a better life. Jewish workers and Jewish masses of Vilna, show your contempt for the Purim general and give him his military command. Panya, Sir Vladimir, evacuate yourself along with your friends from Poland. Down with fascism and anti-Semitism. Down with revisionism. Down with Jabotinsky. Long live socialism. Long live the Bund." Well, the Bund didn't have that long to live. In a bitter irony, Moshe Ahrens writes in his recent book, Flags Over the Warsaw Ghetto, the Bundists hated the revisionists so much that even in the Warsaw Ghetto against the Nazis, they refused to fight together with the revisionists, forcing the revisionists to fight alone. There were two separate undergrounds in the Warsaw Ghetto. So Jabotinsky met with vehement and vocal opposition from some of the official leadership, like the Bundists, but he recognized the greater enemy as well. And in a related context, he wrote, "There is no mightier weapon than indifference. You will never conquer it." And like Rabbi Wein said, inertia is such a powerful force in life. German Jewry were similar in the sense that the communal organizations at first largely opposed emigration and insisted on affirming their rights as Germans. This is true of both religious and secular organizations. March 9, 1933, right after Hitler became chancellor, Jewish newspaper editorialized, "Germany will remain Germany, and no one can rob us of our homeland and our fatherland." And even the German Zionists editorialized that The German Zionist editorialized that Jewry bears great guilt because it failed to heed Theodor Herzl's call and even mocked it in some instances. But years later, the writer publicly regretted what he wrote and said he should have just urged Jews to flee for their lives. Agudat Yisrael, based then in Berlin, called Nazism the admonition of God to all German Jews to return to traditional Judaism. They called for tshuva in response to the growing threat. That was on April 7, 1933. Were there rabbis who told Jews to stay in Europe and not go to America or to Israel? Of course, but I think we exaggerate the extent to which Jews listened to rabbis then and now. And we do find that many rabbis left and told others to leave, and many stayed and were murdered. I've never fully believed that rabbis so dominated people's lives that they would just obey whatever the rabbi says. That has not been my experience, unfortunately. Certainly there was a fear of the irreligious nature of both America and Israel, and some of it was true. My aunt, who went to Israel, was not religious within a very short time, and it was difficult to be part of a religious community at that time and survive. Religious Jews, like right-wing Jews, were not desired by the Zionist establishment, found it more difficult to find employment, and we know today they were actively denied visas when visas were obtainable, even during the war. Some of the objections, though, seem bizarre and overwrought, especially in retrospect. For example, Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, Hashem Kam Damo, who was murdered in 1941, answered a questioner who asked whether he should use the visas offered by Yeshiva University or the Beis Medrash Torah in Chicago and Skokie by writing that those places are too free-spirited. Rabbi Chanan said, Ushtehen hei mekomos sakana beruchnius. Those two places are spiritually dangerous. Kimis halchos beruach chofshios. They operate with a free spirit. Umabetza levrach mi sakana gashmius to sakana ruchnius. And what is the benefit in going from a physical danger into a spiritual danger? This is from June of 1939. He said, but he didn't say not to go. He said, if you're going, contact Rav Shlomo Hyman of Tarvadas. And in fact, Rav Ochanan returned to Lithuania from a U.S. visit in 1939, knowing that war was coming, so he should not abandon his students in Baranovich. So too, Rav Gedalia Shor was an American citizen, gone to learn in Europe, as was the custom amongst those from families interested in that, like we send our kids to Israel today. He went to learn in the late 1930s with Rav Aaron Cutler in Kletsk, and he was told by his parents to return to America in the summer of 1939. He was hesitant to go, and he wrote to Rav Aaron Cutler for advice. Rav Aaron's answer was delayed, and Rav Gedalia Shor was already en route back to America. He later became the Rosh Yeshiva at Tar Vadas when he received Rav Cutler's response, don't go to America. You can remain calmly here in Kletsk, as there is not going to be a war in the near future. Even if you already sold your furniture, Rav Gedalia Shor was married, brought his wife with him to Europe, even if you already sold your furniture, you can easily buy it back. Well, most of Rav Aaron's students were murdered by the Nazis. Rav Aaron himself was saved from the inferno by the Van Hatzolah in 1941, and he became one of the leading and tireless rescue activists in America, noted for his indefatigable efforts that involved Chil Shabbos and really violating any law of the Torah for the sake of Pikuach Nefesh. And of course, there are numerous examples of great Rabbanim who did not leave. I think that the criticism that rabbis are to blame for keeping Jews in Europe is a little misplaced and a little exaggerated. Essentially, they did not necessarily see what was ahead of them. To be done l'kaf schus, hindsight is 20/20. And criticism is undertaken from the perspective of those who know the end of the story. But at the time, no one knew that Hitler was any different than any of the other European tyrants, despots, and Jew haters that Jews had survived for 1,000 years already. My grandfather, Al Mashalm, said to me once when I asked him why he stayed in Poland until 1939, He said after 1,000 years of persecution, you get used to it. So the question is compounded only for those who maintain their Rabbonim, all have Ruach HaKodesh and infallibility in worldly matters. But that hasn't been my experience. Their analysis based on the facts available to them was reasonable. As it turned out, they didn't have all the facts. For classic exposition of the opposite approach, see Rav Dessler in the Michtav Elio, Volume 1, page 75, where he writes of the obligation of the Munas Chachamim and how it is forbidden to think, much less enunciate, that they were wrong about the Holocaust. And yet Rav Amital quoted the Gemara in Baba Kama, Daf Nun Beis, Amud Aleph, Kadrog is Raya al Ono over the Nando Samuta. When the shepherd, meaning Kadosh Baruch Hu, becomes angry with the flock, he appoints for them leaders that are blind. It's not they're intentionally blind. It's simply their vision becomes much more constricted, less peripheral, and they can't see all the factors around them. And of course, we can't ignore the fact that the Holocaust really was sui generis. It was something completely unprecedented that there would be just an attempt to exterminate all Jews, a situation in which even conversion was not an option for survival. A mistake does not diminish a person's greatness, at least if he admits the mistake. Some did leave, of course. Many religious Zionists left in the 1930s, late 1930s especially. Many Ger Hasidim left as well in the late 1930s, although the Ger Rebbe did not leave himself until as a refugee. After the war started, he was spirited out of Egypt and made his way to Eretz Yisrael. So how did Jabotinsky know or surmise or anticipate what some great rabbis did not? Well, like much of the Holocaust, that's God's mystery, and that remains unanswered. There were two other factors that need to be mentioned. One was ideology. The Jews who were Bundists and communists were determined not to leave, but to fight for their worldview in their native countries. And the other factor was age. Just like in the Great Migration, those who fled in the 1930s tended to be young. The old simply had less will and less ability and were more asset heavy and so did not want to leave. To use Germany as an example, again, in June 1933, less than 50% of German Jews were over 40. Meaning, in 1933, German Jews demographically skewed younger. But by the start of the war in 1939, almost 75% of German Jewry were over 40 years old. You understand what happened. Most of the young left. Most of the old stayed behind. They were simply more entrenched and felt they had a greater chance to weather the coming storm than to relocate and start over elsewhere. And German Jews who owned businesses that were Nazis by the Nazis ironically prospered in the German economic recovery of the late 1930s, but they were the exceptions. Even though Jewish poverty in Germany grew to record levels by the late 30s, by the start of the war, nonetheless, some Jews were affluent and so had less interest in leaving. Yet the real horrors of the Holocaust only unfolded after Germany occupied Poland and Western Russia, and those Jews became the overwhelming number of victims of the Nazis, and by then, 1939, 1940, 1941, there was no place to go and almost no way to get there. Those who escaped through the Soviet Union to Shanghai, through Switzerland to France and Spain, were so fortunate as to be considered miracles. Jews died fleeing, of course. Thousands of Jews were hidden by the Poles. Many, for example, one of my aunts, just hid in the forest for years until the war ended. The fact is, it was a nace that anyone survived, whether in hiding or in the camps. The killing machine was that efficient. No one imagined, and for quite a while no one could fully believe, that a civilized country could erect a mechanism, an infrastructure involving assembly, transportation, concentration, and liquidation, just for the purpose of genocide. In fact, the word itself was not coined until 1943. Genocide, the murder of a race or people. All the refugee conferences before the war, during the war, were essentially exercises in expiation of guilt more than practical measures to save large numbers of Jews who receive visas to the United States, to Latin America, to Israel, to Britain, was mostly random as those who survived the concentration camp. There was no one pattern that could explain every case. So we look at the consequences of these decisions. Approximately 6 million Jews were killed during the Holocaust. Difficult to know with certainty how many died. Some estimates are a little more, some a little less. There were less than 1 million survivors, of whom about 150,000 are still alive today. And the 6 million have to be converted into real terms. Most did not have children or grandchildren. If they had, there'd be more than 20 million Jews, maybe 25 million Jews alive today in the world, instead of barely scratching 12 million, still well below our pre-Holocaust count. And it's likely that because of assimilation and intermarriage, we'll never again reach our pre-Holocaust count until, we hope, Yemos HaMashiach. The sad truth is that there were few realistic options in the 1930s for refugees, and those options steadily dwindled throughout the decade. After Kristallnacht, when more Jews wanted to leave, there were fewer places to go. And the Jewish establishments, both in America and in Israel, were not completely welcoming and did not push hard for mass immigration. Most Jews did not think to leave, as most Jews did not think that Hitler could be coming for them. Those who did, in Germany, in Austria, in Czechoslovakia, fled in large numbers. Those who stayed did so for religious, ideological, financial, or personal reasons, all sharing one factor. No one could believe or anticipate the scope of the horror ahead. It was the perfect and most devastating storm. Even Jews today who are familiar with the Holocaust don't often see the handwriting on the wall, whether it's the Jews in the former Soviet Union before they left, or in Iran before they left, or South Africa, Argentina, France, Venezuela. We always think we will weather the storm, and it's always hard to leave. If and when these same questions confront American Jewry, will we respond any differently than did European Jewry? That remains an open and tantalizing question. I thank you all very much. We're going to break for a few weeks, and when we return, we'll discuss the options that Jews in the land of Israel faced before the founding of the state, including the three military groups, the Haganah, the Irgun, Tzailumi, and the Lehi, and what they accomplished and what led different Jews to join different groups. I thank you again.